All right, folks, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Torah Studies. So this week's Torah portion is Teruma, and there's a lot to talk about. Our focus is going to be on Shul, synagogue. Do you know what Shul? So Shul is the Yiddish word for synagogue. Why is it? Where does the word Shul come from?
School.
School. So in German, school is Shul. In fact, if you want to hear what it sounds like in German,
Schule.
Hold on one second. Schule, yeah.
Schule.
I think it's just a long L. I don't know if it's like... Anyway, it's written S-H... Well, in at least in English, S-C-H-U-L-E in German.
Schule.
Schule. Anyway, that's it. So, Schule. Shul is synagogue, so it means a house of prayer. It also means school, I guess, that hints or that intimates to the idea that a shul is also a place where study is happening, like a school, right? Maybe it's not a school directly for kids, for everybody. Everybody can come and learn. So shuls have been around for thousands of years. We've had synagogues throughout the millennia. The amazing thing is, you know the expression, if only the walls could talk? You ever hear that expression? Mm-hmm. Can you imagine if you were able to get the walls of all the shuls that have been around from the beginning, if they could talk, what they would say, what they've seen, what they've been through, right? All the life cycles, all the brisin that happened there, circumcisions, all of the bar mitzvahs, bat mitzvahs, the wedding celebrations, Shabbat before, the Shabbat after, the Sheva Brachot. Some shuls have weddings inside of them. If they're big enough, you have shuls that are the home of, or that see, obviously Kaddish is recited there when somebody passes away. So shuls could speak, they would tell stories about families and lives and children and parents and amazing things. And what about all the amazing tzaddikim that have been to shuls throughout all the years? Great, righteous people. You have wonderful sages and scholars that have walked through and sat down and prayed in synagogues. And of course, synagogues have seen, shuls have seen also very difficult moments. Moments that saw those that did not like Jews or Judaism come in and oftentimes desecrate synagogues and destroy, God forbid, Torah scrolls. So if a shul could talk, if shuls could talk, there would be a lot to say, a lot of amazing things to say. So tonight, shuls are not going to talk. But we're going to talk about shuls. We've asked them to speak. If we read an article, like we asked them for a comment. We haven't heard back yet. So we've asked all the shuls to speak. So we're still waiting on that. But in the meantime, let us talk about shuls. Talk about synagogue. We're going to begin with this week's Torah portion. Torah portion, as I mentioned, is Teruma. And you can find it in your Chumash. Please open up to page 510. 510, 511. And the opening mitzvah, the opening commandment that God is giving to Moshe, God instructs Moshe to speak to the people, v'yichu li truma, and take, God says, take for me a truma. What is truma? It's an offering, a donation. This is the first appeal. First appeal in Jewish history. There have been many appeals since this was the first appeal. You know the famous story they tell about the rabbi who gets up to announce the building campaign. And he gets up on the high holidays and he says, ladies and gentlemen, I want to announce the new building. It's like a buzz in the show. Wow, new building. Yeah, it's going to be beautiful and magnificent. Wow, everyone's buzzing. $10 million. Everyone's like, whoa, it's a lot of money. The rabbi says, and here's the good news. We have the money. Everyone starts cheering. The rabbi says, but it's in your pockets. All right, so this is the first appeal in Jewish history. God says to Moshe, go to the people and ask for the following item. So, Ray, please get us started. Pick it up, if you don't mind, on 511 in the English, the last paragraph where it starts listing the items that are to be donated.
Gold, silver, and copper, turquoise, purple, and crimson wool, linen and goat's hair, ram skins, dyed red, multicolored, tachash skins, and acacia wood. oil for the eternal lamp, spices for the anointing oil, and for the incense fumes, shoham stones, and filling stones for the apron and for the breastplate.
And here is the key verse that we're going to focus on the next page, 513, all the way at the top. You see it? Turn the page the other way. Go, yep, that way. 513 at the top, verse number 8.
What is Tachash?
Tachash. Tachash. Tachash is a mysterious animal that, according to Chazal, only according to the sages, only existed miraculously at this time. It had rainbow. It was multicolored. It's like the unicorn. I don't know that it had a horn, but it's al derech. It's like a it's so unique. It was a special animal that only existed then, according to the sages. Continue.
They should make a sanctuary dedicated to me, and I will dwell among them.
One more verse.
You should make the tabernacle and the design of all its vessels according to all that I show you.
Thank you. Now that verse number 8, Va'asu li mikdash v'shochanti betocham, make a sanctuary and I will come. This is the source of Field of Dreams, right? Remember Field of Dreams? Build it and they will come. Right. This is where it comes from. Va'asu li mikdash, I mean the kaviyach, right? Va'asu li mikdash v'shochanti betocham. God says, build me a sanctuary, build me a mikdash, build me a temple, and that's where I'll be. Wonderful. What does this mitzvah mean? What are we building for God? Mikdash. What's a mikdash? A temple, a sanctuary. So typically we understand that what is it? It's the temple in Jerusalem. It's the Mishkan Tabernacle's portable sanctuary in the desert. But it's this one unique space in the world that... Amy, you have a copy? Okay, good. Pass this down for Karen. So it's this one unique space in the world that is the holiest space on earth. Comes along the Zohar. Zohar is the primary work of Kabbalah. And the Zohar says, not so fast. Don't make it so exclusive. This pasuk, this verse that says there's a mitzvah to build. God says, build me a temple. Build me a mikdash, a holy sanctuary. The Zohar says, this includes all of the mini sanctuaries around the world, i.e. shuls, synagogues, including this one right here, 928 Ponce de Leon Avenue, Atlanta, Georgia. All right, Debbie, please read. We're done with the Chumash for now. I mean, we're never done with the Chumash, right? But let's segue over to the Torah Studies texts. Text number 1b. Page 122. And this is the Zohar's comment on the verse that we just read from our Torah portion, where God says, build a sanctuary and I will dwell there.
What is the meaning of the verse, build a sanctuary for me and I will dwell amongst them? Every synagogue is called a mikdash.
The Zohar says, every shul, every synagogue is called a mikdash. It's called a sanctuary. We know the confusion that sometimes can come about when it comes to the temple here in Atlanta, right? No, I'm kidding. No, somebody told me that they came, who was it? I feel like somebody recently told me, they came from Israel, and people were saying, well, where do you go to, where do you daven, where do you pray? Tefillah. And the temple, and they're like, come, no, I mean, seriously, like, what is that? There's no temple. What are you kidding? What are you mocking me? It's like, where do you go? It's like, no, the temple. It's like when I was a kid. Similar story. When I was a kid, the Chabad yeshiva, the Chabad school, was called Yeshivat Achei Temimim. Yeshiva Achei Temimim. Whatever. It's like a Chabad name. It's Achei Temimim, Tom Achei Temimim. It's like a Chabad name of a school. But we called it, Temim means wholesome. Tamim means like wholehearted and pure and innocent. Yeah. Achei, yeah, like the brothers. Yeah. It's also a girls' school, so it was in the masculine gender. Anyway, the point is that everyone, we all called it yeshiva. There was two schools. There was the Hillel Academy and yeshiva. So I remember I was once at a simcha, at a wedding, And I was young, I was a kid, and somebody, one of the guests from out of town, he sees me, strikes up a conversation, says, so where do you go to school? I said, yeshiva. Which yeshiva? Yeshiva. The guy, it was a funny conversation. I hope you get what I'm saying. Yeshiva means like a Jewish school. Which Jewish school? The Jewish school. Which Jewish school? Yeshiva. It's like, okay, it didn't work. So like, where do you go to daven? The temple. What temple? The temple. All right. So here's the point. The Zohar says every shul, every synagogue is called mikdash. Mikdash means a temple. So when the Torah talks about building a temple, it doesn't only mean a few thousand years ago, either the portable sanctuary that Moses built, or the temple of stones and gold that King Solomon built, or that Ezra rebuilt following the 70-year exile for the second temple, but it means every synagogue, every shul is a mikdash, and that's a very special thing. What does that mean, though? Before we get into what that means, and I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, possibly 12 or more parallels between the temple and a synagogue. And we're going to see how the parallels exist in architecture, interior design, so many different ways we have parallels between the ancient temple of old and our synagogues. But before we get there, I want to read together, and we'll see how even the Talmud, which is not a book that's understood to be a book of Jewish mysticism, even the Talmud celebrates and expresses this connection between our synagogues and the Holy Temple, insofar, in as much as our synagogues are also a home for the divine presence. So let's take a look at that. What I did was I pulled this translation from a wonderful website called, what's it called? What's the website called? Sepharia.
Oh, Sepharia.
Sepharia. Okay, so this is Megillah, Tractate Megillah, page 29a. Unfortunately, it printed really small. I apologize. I was trying to get it bigger. It's really small. I know it's late, and I know it's like at night and whatever. But hopefully, we can all read it together. Okay, so pass this down. 4 pages. We're going to do half of it now, half of it toward the end of the class. Let's begin. Here's where I want to start. Oh, this is very cool. Okay, let's begin. And Amy, I'll ask you to read. Please begin. By the way, the reason why I printed this out like this and I didn't just copy and paste from the English and create a Word document is because I wanted to preserve the original Talmudic language there as well. So you have the Aramaic, or the Hebrew Aramaic, and then the English, and it's nice to learn some Talmud. Right, it's nice to learn from, like, kind of original style. All right, so Amy, please begin. First page, it's the last English paragraph, and it has a little bit of a squiggly, like double S insignia.
Mm-hmm. It is taught in a brewery.
Yep.
Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai says, "Come and see how beloved the Jewish people are before the Holy One, blessed be He. As every place they were exiled, the divine presence went with them. They were exiled in Egypt, and the divine presence went with them. As they stated, 'Did I reveal myself to the house of your father when they were in Egypt?' They were exiled to Babylonia, and the divine presence went with them. As it is stated, 'For your sake, I have sent to Babylonia.' So too, in the future, they will be redeemed. The divine presence will be with them. As it is stated, 'Then the Lord your God will return with your captivity.' It does not state, 'He will bring back,' i.e., he will cause the Jewish people to return, but rather it says, 'He will return,' which it teaches that the Holy One, blessed be He, will return together with them from among the various exiles."
So Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who was a mystic, and the author of the Zohar that we just read, so Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says, no, even when the Jews are in exile, even when the Jews are in exile, God is with them. The Shekhinah, the divine presence, is with them in Egypt, in Babel and Babylonia, and in the future when Mashiach comes, God says, and this is a verse from Deuteronomy, "I will return with your captivity." In other words, God is saying, "I will also be redeemed from the exile," indicating that before the redemption, God is indeed with us in Galut, in exile. Talmud then asked the question, if God is with us in exile, so where is he? Specifically, I need some coordinates. give me the Google Maps version. So continue, turn the page. Second half of the page. The pages are not numbered, but it's the second half of the first sheet. All the way at the top. Amy, please continue.
Wait, sorry, second half of the first sheet?
Straight onto the back. Yeah. I probably made it sound more complicated. It's right there.
The Gemara asks, where in Babylonia does divine presence reside? Abaye said, in the ancient synagogue of Babel, and the synagogue of Babel, and the synagogue that was destroyed and rebuilt in the heart. And do not say that divine presence resides here and there, in both places simultaneously. Rather, at times it resides here in the Babel, and at times there in the heart. Abaye said, I have a blessing coming to me, for whenever I am within the distance of a
So the point is the divine presence is in these synagogues. Now it does say it's either one or the other. Okay, but notwithstanding that, the point is that the Shekhinah is in Shul. Continue. So they were trying to spook him out of the synagogue, and he's like, hey, come on, let them find elsewhere to get somewhere else to go. Let me stay where I am. All right, continue, please.
The verse states, yet I have been to them as a little sanctuary in the countries where they have come. Rabbi Yitzhak said, this is referring to the synagogues and study halls in Babylonia. And Rabbi Elazar said, this is referring to the house of our master, Rav, in Babylonia, from which Torah issues forth to the entire world.
But it's interesting, the first opinion there, Rabbi Yitzchak, says it refers to the synagogues and study halls, plural, in Babylonia. And what is the reference? The verse from Yechezkel, from Ezekiel, that says, I've been to them as a little sanctuary, mikdash ma'at. So here again we have the word mikdash, this idea that you have, of course, the original mikdash, the original Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple, but every synagogue, every Beit Knesset, and every Beit Medrash, every house of prayer and every house of study is a Mikdash Ma'at, is a small sanctuary as well where the Divine Presence resides. How far do I want to go here? Let's do another few paragraphs. If you're still good?
Yeah.
All right. Continue, please. Isn't that an interesting thing? So he said, I used to go to shul, I used to go to synagogue, to daven, to pray. And I used to study at home. Why not? More comfortable, perhaps. But when I heard this verse, when I read this verse in Psalms, which speaks about the fact that God's home, your house, God's, with the capital Y, right? Your house, God's house, is the synagogue. So then I got to show up there. I got to go there to study. So again, all of this speaks to the sanctity, not only the beauty perhaps of a synagogue and how special it is, but the holiness of it, somewhat akin to this idea of the Beit HaMikdash. Yeah.
Is the special reference to the study halls in Babylonia, are those referred to, I understand, because I mean I know that there was, you know, the yeshivot in Babylonia, but I'm just saying this, is it referring to that because that's considered in exile at that point?
Yeah, I would say that that's what it's referring to, especially this is the Babylonian Talmud. So they were writing about, you know, the shuls that they would frequent.
They would frequent.
They might have even written it there.
Okay, like, okay,
literally in that space.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is from the Babylonian
Talmud. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Did I want to point out? Hold on. Yeah. Look at Abaya at the top of the page. Where in Babylonia does the divine presence reside? Abaya said, in the ancient synagogue of Huzal and in the synagogue that was destroyed and rebuilt in Nahardia. And do not say that the divine presence resided here and there. Rather, at times it resided here in Huzal. So he's writing this in Huzal in that first place.
Oh, yeah.
So it's literally like they're speaking of their stomping grounds, for lack of better terms. So the way it's understood subsequently, and we quoted from the Zohar before, every synagogue is called a mikdash. It's not limited specifically to Babel, to Babylonia. It's kind of like in the context, that was where they were, that was the diaspora then, that was where they had the synagogues and the study halls outside of Israel. So that became the focal point of this message. But the message is that where is God's presence found? God is everywhere. But God is, you know, a little extra, a little bit more open, a little bit more accessible in the synagogues and study halls in the diaspora. Even in the diaspora. Take a look. Let's continue, please. Amy, continue. This is a cool idea. Second to last paragraph. Or the last paragraph, sorry.
It is taught in a
Braita. By the way, if you wonder what a Braita is, a Braita is a teaching that was authored in the era of the Mishnah. And let me explain. So what we're studying now is the Talmud, is the Gemara. Now the Gemara is a commentary on the Mishnah. So first you had the Mishnah, and that was written in about the 2nd century, 2nd, 3rd century. Then you have the Gemara, the Talmud, which is written since the Mishnah, from the time the Mishnah was you know, authored and printed, or whatever it was published, however they published it then. So there, whatever was studied and discussed, explaining the Mishnah for the next 200-300 years, that became the Talmud. And that was also edited and also put out for publication. So the Talmud cites earlier sources like the Mishnah and the Braita. What is the Braita? The Braita is a Mishnaic era teaching that didn't make it in the final copy of the Mishnah. So it got cut on the editing floor. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Judah the Prince, is the one who edited the Mishnah about 2nd or 3rd century. He did not include all of the teachings that existed at the time. He only included core teachings. So stuff that wasn't core was also collected and gathered, but it didn't make it into the final version. That's called Braita, related to an Aramaic word that means kind of an outside text. It's not the inside text, the outside text. But the Talmud will cite it as authoritative because, again, it goes back. It's an earlier source than the Talmud itself.
So that's interesting, because I always thought that Braita were additions, but actually they were deletions that were...
Well, they're additional to the Mishnah. In other words, they're teachings in addition to the Mishnah. These are other teachings from that era. But the way it worked is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi sifted through everything that they had and only chose certain core teachings. Everything else is Braita. Okay, so that just to explain that term. Well, and from this point, the Talmud, for the next few lines, the Talmud is going to explain how that verse tells us that the synagogues and study halls will be transported to Israel. However, understand what this is actually saying. When Mashiach comes, all of the shuls and all the study halls will be transported and be convened in Israel. You with me on this? That's buckle up for the flight. You know?
It'd be easier if we're in shul.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, okay, we're here. We're good. We're good to go. But wait, I forgot something at home. Okay, so let's, so continue with the explanation of what that means and how that verse tells us this idea.
Argument? Carmel, which came only momentarily to study Torah, were relocated and established in Eretz Israel in reward for their actions. All the more so should the synagogues and study halls in Babylonia, which the Torah is read and disseminated, be relocated to Eretz Israel.
Okay, so it's an interesting thing. If these two mountains came only momentarily to study Torah and were established in Israel as a reward, so too the synagogues and study halls, where Torah is read and disseminated constantly, certainly they should be relocated. Okay, so there you go. I think we're going to skip the next point. That's also about Sinai and about the experience with the mountains. It kind of goes off tangential. And then the next part, on the next page, the next little double S thing, we'll save toward the end of the class. So, what's clear from the Talmud and the Zohar is that in lieu of a temple, of a central holy temple, or central Mishkan tabernacle, we have shuls, we have synagogues, and we have study halls, and that's the space of holiness amongst the Jewish community. So that is the mini-temple, or the temple, of the diaspora, of the communities that we have. Okay, so what's interesting is that, like I mentioned before, once we establish a link, a conceptual link between the temple of old and the synagogues of today or of yesteryear as well, so now we can see how a lot of the details regarding a synagogue actually stem from the details and the laws regarding the temple itself. If you recall, we started off the class by discussing how the temple was to be funded. Who was supposed to build the temple? Not even build. Who was supposed to provide the materials for building the temple? The community, right? This is the first appeal. God says to Moshe, speak to the people, v'yichu li truma. Take from me a donation. Take from me an offering. Gold, silver, copper, the various color wools, etc., right? All of that was discussed. So if you're building a temple, if you're building a mishkan, a temple, whatever, where should the funds come from? The people. One comes to a shul. Who should build the shul? Who do you think? The community. Take a look at... Before we get... this is good. This is perfect. Text number 3. Sarah, take it away. Now we're out of the Talmudic text. We're back into the Torah studies text. Here we have Rambam, Maimonides, in his Laws of Prayer, chapter 11. The very first thing he says there, in chapter 11, it's interesting that his discussion of contributions to the synagogue is found in chapter 11. Go for broke. Text number 3.
Any place where 10 Jews live requires a structure to be used for prayer. This place is called a Beit HaKnesset, and the townspeople may coerce one another to contribute to its construction.
So again, who contributes to its construction? Just like the temple, it is the people, the community. Exactly. So again, that's a parallel that we see between the temple of old and the temples, if you will, of new. Now, take a look at what the Mishnah Brewer says. What if the people in the community can't afford to buy a building or to build a building for a synagogue? What should they do? Text number 4. Karen?
If they are unable to build one, they must at least rent a place designated for prayer.
So you have to have a place. Ideally, you buy or build something. If not, you can rent a storefront or whatever. That's what we do today. I don't know what it was back then. But you can rent a space, but you have to have a community of 10 people has to have, you know, an established headquarters, so to speak, for the divine presence for the synagogue. Now, what happens? What about the upkeep of the synagogue? So the people built it. But as we know, when you build something, it needs repairs. You have to paint it, repaint the walls, and you have to fix, you know, nowadays we have plumbing and electrical stuff. Whatever, you have to fix stuff. So who pays for that? Well, let's look back at the temple. Maybe it's not in the opening of this week's Torah portion, but we know in Jewish law who contributed to the upkeep of the temple. It was the people, right? There was a fund called the Bedek HaBayit, which is for the repairs of the building of the temple, and it was funded by the community. So who do you think pays for the repairs of a synagogue? Here we go. Text number 5.
Yeah. If the synagogue requires repairs for instance, if rain leaks into it, or if the walls are damaged and the like, the townspeople can be coerced to fund the repairs. However, in my opinion, they cannot be coerced to fund unnecessary decoration.
You like that distinction? He says, okay, look, if the issue is structural, right? If it's like, if there's damage and whatever, okay, then y'all have to chip in. But if it's like, you know, I want to have a different lighting, that's, you know, that may be something else. Continue.
If there is a disagreement as to whether repairs are necessary or unnecessary, the matter should be decided by the local basis.
Right, that's the next layer. So if it's necessary, everyone's got to chip in. If it's not necessary, you don't have to. If you want to, you can, you don't have to. But who decides if it's necessary or unnecessary? So you got to sometimes take it to the betin to decide what is indeed necessary. What is the point? The point is, again, so just like the temple is built and maintained by the community, by the people, so too is a mini temple, if you will, a synagogue built and maintained by the community. So I feel like I want to lay this out again. Just take a step back, and what are we doing here? What we're going to do is go through a bunch of interesting laws regarding a synagogue, regarding a shul. Who builds it? How's it funded? Right? Who does the repairs? How's that funded? Where do you build it? What about the architecture? What does it look like? What are the features that go inside of a shul, inside of a synagogue? And we'll look through all these details, which on their own are fascinating, like how to build a shul. This is like basic shul building 101. In case you want to build a shul, now you'll know how to do it. But in addition to that, each step of the way, we're going to draw a parallel between the synagogue and the ancient temple. Let's continue and talk about the structure of the building itself. How to design a shul. Here is building code for a synagogue. Text number 6. Doctor.
A synagogue must be built at the highest point of a city. It should reach higher than all the homes in the city designated for use, excluding towers and citadels that are not used.
So the Shulchan Aruch Code of Jewish Law says two things. Number one, build it at the highest point of the city. And number two, the building itself should be taller than the other buildings in the city that are being used. You can have a watchtower that's higher, but if it's a building that's in use, the synagogue should be the highest. Before we get into details of like what, where is that happening, before we get to that obvious question, let me ask another question. That is, what does this remind you of? What else was built on top of a mountain? The temple, the Beit HaMikdash, was built on the Temple Mount. Right, so it's built on top of, you know,
but
a top.
I was just getting ready to ask, is that, that's not,
what's interesting is, I don't know if it's the highest point today, but from what I understand, from what I've read, at least back in the day, it was the highest point. Sometimes, you know, you can build up areas and make them higher. So whether that's the case or not, I don't know. But back in times of King Solomon, who was the first one to build the temple, he built the first temple, it was the highest place. So it's interesting, again, not only is this a law about a synagogue, but it's paralleling this Mikdash, the Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple, that just like that was built high, so too, a shul needs to be built out.
Not only on the highest points, but if it's not high enough, you raise it.
Raise the roof. Yeah, but so the question then is, why don't we do this? Right? Why don't we do this?
Which actually, the temple down the street is actually pretty high.
So maybe that's why it earns its name, the temple, because it's the only one that's doing it. No, but really, like, we don't... When was the last time that you heard of a shul that's like, wait, we can't buy there because it's not the highest point of the city. We have to buy on top of the hill. Like, when was that a part of... Right? Is that... So Jewish... It's an interesting discussion. Let's first read text numbers. I'll read text 7. The Meiri says something interesting. He's a commentary on the, in his commentary on the Talmud tractate Shabbat, he says the following. It is also permissible to build structures higher than the synagogue when the intention is not to demonstrate authority, but merely to allow for more stories and residents. In other words, it's all about what statement is it making. The shul in a Jewish community should be the statement building. It should be the prized possession, not possession, but the prize. Like, it should be the crown jewel of a Jewish community, should be the synagogue. That should be the best, the most beautiful, the highest, the biggest. It should be the best. But if people have to live in a high-rise, I don't know what the Meiri's high-rise in the 1200s, I don't know what kind of skyscrapers they had, or condo buildings. But he says, if you have another building that happens to be taller, but it's for residential purposes, it's for housing or whatever, then it's not making a statement that, oh, that's more impressive than the synagogue. The synagogue is still the most impressive. This is just to allow for housing and perhaps a tight, a small neighborhood. Does it make sense? So a few things about modern synagogues. Number one, in America at least, we don't have the luxury of telling people to stop building higher than our synagogues. It's not a thing. No one can go tell the... I was going to mention the Mercedes-Benz Stadium, but that's not... It's whatever. It is what it is. You're not going to say, oh, hey, you can't build it too high because it's taking away from the glory of the shul. I mean, you can, but it's not really an expectation that you can have. So you build the shul to the best of your ability. You're not going to stop other construction. You know, we don't have that type of leverage here in the United States. Do we always have the luxury of kind of cherry-picking which hill we're going to build the shul on, and, you know, let's build it up so that it starts off at the highest place? Again, that also might not be so practical given just pragmatic considerations. So text 6 is the ideal. Text 7 already opens the door for some compromise, and the unspoken text 7.2 or whatever it is what I'm talking about, and that is the understanding is, look, build it as nice and as big and as beautiful as you can, and that's basically the best we can do today. Make sense? I know it's a little bit disappointing, but that's the way it plays out.
Does it imply that, Alex, I think my mom said that, I wonder whether she said this was in Israel or not, but she said that people put more money into community buildings and shuls than they do in their private residences, whereas in the United States, people put more money in their private residences than in the communal building.
I think the message that we get from all of these texts, especially these specific ones about building, is that, I don't know if it has to be more or less, whatever, but definitely has to be a focus. It's a value. Look, the way it is in life is, if you value something, you typically invest in it. They're the things that you really value. So the question is, what do we value? And tonight's question is, maybe, what ought we value? Like, what's really important? And the message here is, look, if we had the opportunity, if we had a temple in Jerusalem, that would be amazing, right? We would all be blown away. The point is, we have every shul, every house of Torah study is a mini temple. It's a special place. We shouldn't take it for granted. It's not just another building. It's a very special thing. So whether it is the highest or it's not the highest, you know, physically, is another question. But the point is that it's meant to evoke. It's meant not even evoke. It's meant to be something really beautiful. So that I think is consistent with that message. Now, you know, if it's not like that currently in the U.S., so there's room to grow into it. Those that have arrived, it's boring. They already have that value. Now what are they going to do? Go on vacation. So we can work on it. We have work to do. All right, now, so that's as far as building it and the height of the building. Let's get into some of the architectural details. So first of all, how is a synagogue oriented directionally? Like, so now we know where it's built and kind of how it's built, sort of like the construction of it, the outside. But once you get inside, how do you position a synagogue? So famous, yeah. Which direction do we pray? Jerusalem. Why Jerusalem?
That's where
the temple was. Again, this correlation between synagogues and temples. We face Jerusalem. We face that way east. Because if we kept on going this way, all right, maybe we'll end up in England or some or Europe. But if you kind of maybe alter it a little bit, the general direction is toward Jerusalem. By the way, if you're praying, and we've discussed this before in these classes, if you're praying in, if you live in South Africa, your synagogues face north. And if you're in Russia, your synagogues face west. Southwest, I guess. Point is that we're always facing Jerusalem. What about the doors to a synagogue? I'm going to mention now over the next few minutes some details that you might not, that might seem a little inconsistent. But don't be alarmed. Or be alarmed. But sometimes you do the best that you can. But text 8 is one of those examples of don't be alarmed. You'll look around, you're like, wait a second, I'm with you. It's not 100% like we're saying here, but this is the way, at least it's written in the books. Text number 8. Right. Page 127, yeah.
The synagogue entrance must be opposite whichever direction the townspeople face during prayer. For instance, if the townspeople pray facing west, the entrance must be on the eastern side of the building, so that upon entering, they will be positioned to bow facing the ark.
Which means that in our case, when we pray facing east, we pray that way. Where should the entrance be? That way, so that when you walk in, you're ready to go. Why is that? Also the temple. The main entrance of the temple was positioned in a way that when you walked in, you were facing the Holy of Holies right away. That was the main, many entrances, but the main one that was used is the one that when you walked in, you were facing toward the Holy of Holies. So if we are praying in a synagogue toward Jerusalem, ideally you set the doors that when you walk into the sanctuary, you're facing where you need to go. And not coming in and then making a this or making a that. Or like, oh, whoops, it's behind me. That's awkward if you come in by the ark. Hey, oh, hey, guys. Let me just slink back here to the back of the synagogue. So ideally, our door should be right there. If anybody wants, they can hang out in a little storage area back there. And then have that as their entrance, although it's a little bit tight with all the chairs in there. But it's possible, theoretically. Those are our doors. Coming through the windows that don't open. I was thinking, like, is that door? Yeah, but it's kind of facing that way. But then you come in this way. Oh, you know what? This entrance.
It's the main entrance.
There you go. And then this entrance right here. You know what? We're good. I just decided. We're good. Right here, that archway, right here, that doorway. That's good for me. Doesn't mean entrance. Who says entrance means off the street? Maybe entrance means entrance. We have to stop using that one. And everyone's invited to use this one. And then we're good to go. Look at that. Whew, saved the shul. Oh, that was close. I'm glad we worked that out. Because that was, you know, it's not the highest building on Ponce. Ponce City Mark, or actually that's, on a, whatever. Listen, this is the building code. You know, sometimes they get exemptions. The inspector comes around, they're like, okay, fine. Right? You give them some schnapps, okay, fine. We'll let it go. Some kichel, for sure, whatever you want. I'm kidding. The point is, you do the best that you can. I know shuls that don't even face east in the U.S. And they don't because the way the building is situated, you can't really do it for whatever reason. So you do the best that you can. But these are the ideals because, again, it's supposed to, as close as possible, emulate or somehow be directed toward the ancient temple in Jerusalem. That's the idea. So we face east here. We come in from the west like they did in the temple. Another feature. Let's continue with the interior design. What was the holiest item in the temple in Jerusalem? The ark. And what was in the ark? The Torah, the tablets. What do we have in a synagogue? Wouldn't you know it? The Aron Kodesh, the Ark. We also have an Ark. The temple, both temples, I'm sure. The temple in Jerusalem had an Ark, right? We also have an Ark that had Torah in it, Ten Commandments. We also, by the way, I'm sure you've seen it. Some curtains have depicted on the curtains the Ten Commandments, the tablets. It's not by coincidence. It's not random that they put it there. Again, it's significant. If the ark is meant to emulate the ark, so I don't know if anyone has an original two tablets, Ten Commandments. If you do, that's kind of special. That's probably worth a lot of money, right? It's amazing. But we sometimes replicate that, at least adorn it, the covering, in the synagogue. Now, let's read this inside. Text number 9. Debbie. Right, so here we go. This is the eastern side, so we're facing there. So the ark should be on the eastern, far eastern wall. We got that one checked off. Right, okay, good. Now, let's look at another detail. In many arks that you've seen, I'm sure, and this ark as well, in front of the box, in front of the ark itself, there is a curtain. You ever wonder why there's a curtain there? You ever wonder? If an ark means a box, so you have a box, right? We have a cabinet here. The cabinet has, right, what's the parochah? What's the curtain for? It's a design detail of the temple. In the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, the Torah says, in front of the Holy of Holies, there was a curtain. So we have a curtain. You understand what's going on here? A shul is designed to replicate, in a sense, the Holy Temple. Let's read this inside. Amy, text number 10. This is Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. So there you go. Another parallel, another design feature. Now let's talk about the bima. Not the beamer. That's a car. The bima. And it's not like a Boston accent saying bima. So here we have the bima. What is the bima? Bima means, really means a platform. It's a table, platform, a stage. So we sometimes this is kind of called a bima over here. Although I don't know, when you say bima, do you refer to the fact that oftentimes the bima is on kind of an elevated platform, or is this itself a small elevated platform? I don't know. But let's look at it inside text number 11. Sorry, take it away. So it's clear that it's not actually this piece, it's the actual platform that he stands on, that's called the bima, but we call this the bima as well. We don't have the platform, all we have is this. So the Torah reader reads the Torah from here. Now that is meant to symbolize the mizbeach, the altar, again another piece of furniture, so another item, another vessel in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. Text 12, Karen. These are all small texts, so we're kind of rapidly.
Bima is considered to be like the altar in the temple. That is the reason we circle the bima on Sukkot in lieu of the circuits around the altar in temple times. Now, the inner altar that stood in the sanctuary, meaning the incense altar, stood in the middle of the temple between the menorah and the shulchan. Inasmuch as our bima is situated inside, as the incense altar was, it is appropriate to place it in the middle of the synagogue so as to make the synagogue, our miniature temple, as similar to the temple as possible.
So where do you put the bima platform upon which you read the Torah? In middle of the shul, in middle of the synagogue. This becomes another important feature. Also, the bima is meant to emulate the altar, the Mizbeach. To get up to the altar, there was a ramp. So it was kind of like an elevated structure. So the same thing is true with, in many synagogues, we don't have it here, but of a smaller synagogue, but in many large synagogues, you have the bima the way it's intended to be, which is on a raised platform. By the way, we've spoken before about the fact that a person should stand for the Torah reading. You shouldn't sit when the Torah is read on the same level as you. So that's why the bima was built, not only so that everyone can hear it, but also to give that space so that theoretically you could sit down because the Torah is being read on a different level. But the point is that just like the altar, the Mizbeach, was not only elevated, but it was also in the middle of the Kodesh, of that building called the Holies, so too our bimot, the bimas that we have, are also meant to be situated in the middle of the synagogue. This becomes very important. Historically, the bima in the Torah was read always in the middle of the synagogue. But then, a few hundred years ago, synagogues started emulating a little bit more other religions' houses of worship. And they started moving the bima up to the front. Kind of like, I would say it's more of, it kind of evokes more of a, like a stage presentation, like kind of like a, like you're the audience and it's kind of like, it's, you know, it's what you're watching as opposed to something that you're in the middle of. Right? It's like, yeah, the stage is in the front and you're in the back, as opposed to the traditional way of where you put the bima, where the action happens, the Torah is read, is right in the middle of the synagogue.
You mean the middle between the ark and the entrance?
Ideally it's right from the back to the front, front being the ark, back being the entrance where you come in, according to what we read before, it should be in the center of the synagogue. Yeah. The Rebbe says in text 13 something interesting.
When you teach here, do you use the beam?
Yeah. So when we do services.
When you teach, when you have classes.
No. Right. So, no, because I mean, when it's used as a shul, as a synagogue, then it has these features. Yeah. Then I don't think it always has to be put there. By the way, I'm going to get to this idea of a mixed use shul soon. Right now, we've been talking about a structure that's pretty much only used as a shul. We'll talk about, can you use a shul for other things? Can you use it for, you know, a party, a celebration? You know, can you eat and drink in a synagogue? Is that respectful? We'll get to that very soon.
What is the significance of being, I mean, I realize we're emulating the temple, but and maybe it's somewhere in the Talmud, but that this is going to be, the altar is going to be between the menorah and the shulchan.
That's where it was placed. Physically, that's where it was placed. He's saying, I'm sure there is. I'm sure there's lots of layers of meaning on that. One message for us, that again, that's the altar. Message for us about the bima, which is where we read the Torah, is that Torah is not the exclusive. You know, the Torah is not meant for those up front. Torah is not just, you know, a members only type of access thing. And that, you know, somebody will tell you what the Torah is saying. Torah is meant to be, we're all meant to be equidistant from the Torah. Torah is meant to be amongst the people, so to speak. All right, so the Rebbe says, you know, when there are questions about practically how to do it, if the synagogue is situated in a way where it becomes difficult to put the bima right in the middle, so the Rebbe has the following advice, text 13. Karen, are we up to you? I have no idea what we're up to. David, please read, text 13.
There should be at least one row of seats situated between where the Torah is read and the Holy Ark.
So if it has to be a little bit more toward the front, then at least have a row of seats in between the bima and the ark. Don't just have it like right in the front, which is why when we do services here, we have two seats. I usually sit there just to make sure we're doing this right. Two seats right in front of the ark, right in front of the bima. So there's a row of seats right here between the bima and the ark. So we got it covered. Yeah. This bima is right over. Yeah, the bima is typically, I want to say, like over here, right over here. Yeah, because we have the mechitza here, so women here, men here. So we put it over here, which is a little bit toward the front, but we have a row of seats. We could theoretically move it back, but then where would you? No, you're still safe. I wouldn't want to kick you. That's on wheels. Yeah. Oh yeah, this is great. We had this custom made. Remember Barry?
Yeah,
he's Barry, and Barry should be well. His health has been an issue the last few years, but yeah, he built this. This is great. This is a fantastic bima. Solid wood. It rolls like a charm. In fact, we had a, there's a, you know those soapbox races?
Yeah.
Yeah, they have Bema races locally. It's not as advertised, but synagogue Bema race down the hill, down Peachtree. And so this one came in. Yeah, you know it, right? The rabbi's like, go Bema, go. And it's like, I'm in my Bema. All right, I'm going to drop that joke. Now, let's look at, if you want to see what I'm talking about, text 14a. The Chafetz Chaim says this, text 14a. Yeah.
Due to our many sins, some communities have broken an age-old tradition and have started to place the Bema near the Holy Ark in an effort to emulate the non-Jewish houses of worship. To these people can be applied the verse, Israel has forgotten his maker and has built temples.
In other words, they forgot God and built temples, but other types of temples. Continue.
The latter halachic codifiers have already written at length about the trouble with such conduct.
Yeah. One more, text 14b.
Lately, people have started to deviate from Jewish practice and have placed the Bema to the side. Their punishment is great, for without reason they arrogantly seek to deviate from an ancient and logical custom.
So whereas the other customs are pretty much more adhered to, pretty much everyone has the Ark on the far wall or whatever it is, the Bema seems to have been moved at some point, not so long ago. So the point is that we should try to revive this or try to hold on to this Jewish tradition of putting the Bema in the middle. Again, it harkens back to the altar, which was in the middle. And of course, as I mentioned, Torah is meant to be in the center and around which everyone is equidistant. So it's a beautiful custom, and it's something that is worthy of mentioning here. Okay, let's see if we covered everything that I had. So Ark, curtain, Bema in the middle, Bema elevator we spoke about. Oh, one other point that's not mentioned here. So there is a custom regarding the number of windows that are supposed to be built. You're building a shul, building a synagogue. How many windows should be put in? 12. So the custom to do 12. Maybe one for each of the tribes. It's like, I would never pray through that window. Joking. Not that we're getting tribal. But each, you know, there's 12. You've probably seen synagogues that have stained glass windows. And sometimes the stained glass has a depiction, an image of each of the 12 tribes. You'll have the lion for Judah, and you'll have the Naphtali is the deer, and you know, different animals or different depictions. Exactly, you have different depictions. So 12 windows. You don't have to. I think we're a little bit short of 12 here, I'm noticing, unless you count each panel, right? Yep, we got 12, we're good. 1, 2, 3, 4 for the door. Let's call this 5, 6, 7. How many are there?
It was built to be.
How many?
Seven.
But you could count this as
8, 9, 10. Wait. We're close. Hold on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Let's call that a window. 11. Bathroom.
Double door.
We're good. However you want to slice it, we are totally good. We totally got 12. Don't make me count that again because I'll come up with a different 12. But we got it. All right. So. Now you know a little bit more, perhaps, about how to build a shul, what it means to build a shul, that a shul is kind of like a mini temple or like a temple itself, a place of holiness, of the Shekhinah, the Divine Presence. In fact, it seems like the Divine Presence back in the day tried to spook people. It's like, ooh, why is he still there? Right? But the Divine Presence is there and is here, is in a shul. And therefore, it's built in a certain way. And of course, the upshot of this is that there's a certain type of decorum that has to take place in a shul. If it's a place of the Divine Presence, so we have to act in a certain way to be respectful of the holiness of the space. Text 15. I think I just read. Did I just read? I did not read. Okay. So text 15, I'll read. This comes from the Code of Jewish Law. One may not act with lightheadedness. I don't think that means that you didn't have enough to eat or drink, and that was it. But it means kind of like trivial. One may not act with lightheadedness in synagogues and in houses of study. One may not laugh, joke, or idly chatter. Right? We're like, whoa, wait a second, hold on, this is very serious. Nor may one eat or drink in them. I don't know what we're talking about here, but I don't know what's in here, but certainly not any drinks. Stroll in them or use them as shelter from the sun or rain. Now this sounds very specific. And there's a lot of things that cannot be done. Okay. Okay. I'll read the next few texts. We've gone around a few times. Text 16, respect for a synagogue is because it is considered a minor temple. As it is written, yet have I been to them as a little sanctuary. Now regarding the temple, it is written, you shall revere my sanctuary, meaning we must revere the one who dwells within it. So the same, just like you have to revere the Beit HaMikdash, the holy temple in Jerusalem, you have to have this reverence for the many temples of shuls, of synagogues, and houses of study. So again, the question is, what about Verbrengens? Bring it on. Like, how do you have like a Verbrengen where there's food and there's, you know, it's alcohol and other things, right? Chalent, how do you do a kiddush inside a shul? What's going on here? You can never eat inside a shul. And what about the fact that sometimes shuls are mixed use? In Pittsburgh, the Chabad Synagogue, which is a very large synagogue, a few hundred people daven there every Shabbos, 300-400 people, in the big Chabad Shul. In the weekday, it's used as a gym. They have a carpet in there, a sports carpet. They roll out from storage next to the Ark. They have these big storage closets. Huh?
Basketball
hoops. They roll out the basketball hoops, and you play. You could dribble. It's a special carpet that you can dribble on. And that's it. It's a party. So how does that work? So I need to share. Oh, you know, before I answer that question, let's take a look at text number 17. This is from Rambam. If a synagogue or house of study has two entrances, one should not use it for a shortcut. If you're walking on Ponce and you want to get to the back alley and you're like, oh, don't want to walk up that driveway. I don't know why. But you're like, oh, let me just go through Chabad. You can't use it as a shortcut. To enter through one entrance and leave through the other, to reduce the distance one travels, because it is forbidden to enter these buildings except for a mitzvah. So if you enter, you have to pray or study something or whatever it is. You could say even just a quick verse and you're okay. And then you can go out the other side. But you can't use it as a shelter. You can't use it as a lunchroom. You can't use it as these things. The question then is, so how do we do all this? I want to share a story. A story happened in Neville. Neville was a Hasidic community back in the old country. And one time, the mashpia, the spiritual mentor, got up on Shabbat and said, look, the reality is that we're all here to pray. But it seems that before prayer, after prayer, there's a lot of mundane talk about business. How's business? How's the buying and selling? How are your horses? How are your wagons? How's your cow? How's your chicken? Right? All this mundane stuff. It doesn't really belong in a synagogue. And the people accepted his words. And they stopped talking mundane stuff. A month later, he got up in synagogue and said, folks, I rescind my suggestion. Bring it back. Talk about the other stuff. Why? Because because it used to be, everyone knew what was going on with the other. So you knew that the fellow's chickens weren't doing well. So if you knew some chicken medicine, so you helped him out. Or if the cow died, so you threw him a few bucks because you knew about it. But that's when people found out about what was going on. They found out in the shul. So if you take that away, if it's only about the prayers, so then you're missing the communal aspect of it. Of course, this has to be taken within a certain measure, but it brings out this idea that there is another element to a shul. In addition to the prayer, in addition to the study, in addition to the holiness and the Shekhinah that's there, there's another element. And that is that it's a place where people can connect not only with God, but with each other. And connect in a way that benefits each other spiritually and also materially. On a very practical level. And so, therefore, many shuls, most shuls, maybe all shuls, are built al tanai, with a condition. If you build a shul, you can make a condition that this building is going to be used as a synagogue, but it will also be used for other things as well. We're going to eat here, we're going to drink here, we're going to fabreng here, we may play basketball here. If you have that condition, if you create that condition, from the beginning, then it allows it to be opened up. Now, you can't make a condition that the shul is going to be a casino. I don't know why I picked casino, but I'm figuring something that probably would not be so kosher, right? But if it's a kosher activity, but just a little bit mundane, then there's a way to get around it. In fact, I heard this week from the Chabad rabbi in, I think he's the rabbi in somewhere in Europe. He said the shul in Prague, the Maral shul. Has anybody been there to Prague? So what's it called? What's the shul called? The Altnai shul. Right? Altnai. Which means alt and nai. It's old and new. It's the old new shul. But Altnai, some say, is alt and nai. Unconditioned. It's the unconditioned shul. It's a shul that they made a condition. They could use it for other purposes, like building a golem or whatever it is, whatever would come around, whatever they would need to do in the synagogue. So the point is that there's much more, not much more, but there's also more things that could be done in a synagogue, especially if it benefits the community in a spiritual way and a material way, because at the end of the day, that is what it's about. It's about people, and it's about spirituality, but it's also about understanding where people are. I want to see if we should read this or if we should. I think we should conclude it. If you want to read the last section of the Talmud, you can take this home or you can read it here. It basically talks about certain things that you should not do with the synagogue, like use it as a shortcut. It talks about if a synagogue goes into disrepair, if there's grass growing in a former synagogue, can you take your animals to graze there inside the synagogue that now is grass growing through? And the answer is no, because it's disrespectful. So the Talmud discusses some things that should not be done out of respect to a synagogue. So I thought it was interesting. So I included the whole excerpt here. But that's it for tonight. Thank you very much for joining me. So the message here is, shul is a very special place. A synagogue is a temple of God, and it has the divine presence. And so may we appreciate the shuls that we have, and may we feel truly the holiness that we have access to in shul. Thank you very much for joining me for Torah Studies.